WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. On January 21, 1995, Azim Kamisa got the phone call that every parent dreads. He learned that his 20-year-old son Tariq had been robbed and murdered while delivering pizzas. He later found out that the boy who killed his son was a 14-year-old named Tony Hicks, who was a member of a gang. Hicks was charged as an adult, pled guilty, and is now serving a 25-year-to-life sentence in a California prison. What makes this story unusual is that Azim Kamisa reached out to the grandfather and guardian of his son's killer, a man named Ples Felix. They have become friends and work together to prevent juvenile crime. Kamisa founded an organization named after his son, the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, and asked Ples Felix to serve on the advisory board. Together, they visit schools, tell their personal stories, and help young people negotiate violent confrontations. And children, they find, are all too familiar with violence. The Tariq Kamisa Foundation, which is based in San Diego, has received many awards, including one from the Children's Defense Fund and the National Crime Victims Special Community Service Award. Kamisa has written the new book, Azim's Bardo, A Father's Journey from Murder to Forgiveness. I asked him to tell us what happened to Tariq the night he was killed.
My son was a student at San Diego State. In fact, he was on this campus where we are today. And he finished his sophomore year, and he was actually in his sophomore year, and he worked Fridays and Saturdays delivering pizzas. And this was the last delivery on a Saturday night, and he worked for a restaurant on Adams Avenue called D'Amelio's Restaurant. It's an old Italian family restaurant. And went to deliver a pizza that was ordered on Louisiana Street. It's an area where the restaurant delivered fairly often. And he stopped at four different addresses because he was given a bogus address. And the pizza was ordered by a youth gang. Their name was the Black Mob. And when he couldn't find the address, he came back to his car and put the pizzas back in the in his Volkswagen hatchback. And he was jumped by four youths. Three of them were 14 years old, and the leader of the gang was 18 year old.
It was a setup. It was a setup then.
It was a setup. They have a term for it. It's called jacking the pizza man. And they demanded the pizza from him. He refused. He got into the car and was backing away. And the 18-year-old gave the order to Ples's grandson, Tony, to shoot or bust him bones, was the words that he used. And Tony fired the 9mm gun. And, of course, the bullet was fatal. He was backing out and entered the back of his neck and went through both his lungs and ruptured his aorta, and he killed him on the spot.
How, then, did you learn that your son had been killed?
Well, I was I just flew in from Mexico that day, and my work is a lot of international investment banking, so I travel a lot. And I'd gone to a party. Some friends of mine had picked me up and we'd gone to a 50th party. And they dropped me back at my house. And the next morning, when my mate came in, there was a note from an investigative sergeant that they were trying to reach Tariq's family.
And did
so I called over to the telephone number and was put in touch with a sergeant that gave me the news on the phone. Of course, my mind wouldn't accept that would be true. You think they must have made a mistake. It can't be him.
This is a phone call, of course, that every parent dreads. How did you digest the information that your son had been killed the night before?
I just wouldn't accept it. I was certain that they'd made a mistake, and I quickly hung up on the sergeant and called his home, because just 3 weeks before he tragically died, he had moved in with his fiancée, Jennifer. So when I called his house, of course, Jennifer was all in tears and crying, and she'd known about it early that morning, about 4, and I found out about 8. So, of course, then is when the shock really hit me.
What were the range of emotions that you had? And you talk about the shock, but what else did you experience?
What I experienced is that all life absolutely drained out of me. I felt like I had a body without anything in it, whether the soul had left. It felt like I was it was like a nuclear bomb that detonated inside of me, that I was broken into millions of smithereens that could never ever come back together. You wonder, when you bring up your children, you bring up, Tariq was brought up with very good values, and I came from a very spiritual home, and, he knew what was right, what was wrong. Tariq was had very high integrity. He's also a very kind person. And he stood up for what he thought was right, and to that extent, I'm very proud of him. It took a lot of courage to do what he did. And it's sad that when you stand up for something that is right and it costs you your life, you have to think that our society is needs to examine some of the values we are teaching our children.
Did your son ever express worries about his job, feeling that there was some potential danger?
No, Tariq and I had a great relationship, and he lived in San Diego the last 3 years of his life. And I had a part-time job for him in an office environment, but Tariq is not one to sit in an office. He loved to drive, and he liked the outdoors. And I had never in my life thought that pizza delivery would be a dangerous thing. He found the job by himself. I was proud of him. I was a student in England when I was going to college, and I worked delivering mail and parcels. So it was interesting that he chose to deliver pizzas.
In the shock of dealing with what had happened to your son, did you ever want revenge? Did you ever want to get even with his killer?
No. About an hour and a half after I had made my calls, I had to call his mother and my daughter, which were very excruciating calls, and also my mother. And my dad had a 12-and-a-half-hour surgery 2 days prior and could not be told of the tragedy for several days after it happened. And I just don't know how my mom got through the visiting hours. But then I called a good friend of mine who lives near me, and he said, don't do anything. Mm. I and Kit are on my way. And Dan and Kit were by my side an hour and a half later. And, of course, I live by myself, and Jennifer, Tari's girlfriend's parents, live in Hawaii, so she was by herself. And she left to pick up, Kit left to pick up Jennifer, and I was alone with Dan. And one of the first things Dan said, and by this time we knew it was a youth gang-related incident, and one of the first words out of Dan's mouth were that, whoever these kids are, I hope they fry in hell. And I told him right then, I said, I don't feel that way. I see victims on both ends of the gun.
Did that surprise you to hear yourself say that? Because, frankly, it surprises me to hear you say it.
Yeah.
To say it so immediately after your son's death.
Yeah, it was very immediate. And I've tried to figure out, you know, why that was my response, because Dan absolutely couldn't. He broke down and started to cry. He says, I wouldn't have the strength to do that if my son Adam was taken away like that. And, you know, you think, why did I? Well, and I've been asked this question many times, and sure. I've just finished a book, and I've tried to answer this question as to why was that my response. And I think that I really don't know the answer to that question, but there's two possibilities. One is that I grew up, as I said earlier, in a Muslim family, and my mom's very spiritual, and we had a lot of values taught to us very young. And I grew up in a loving family, and you know, revenge and fighting and terror were not part of my upbringing. So maybe if anybody else had grown up the same way as I did, maybe would have had the same systematic response. However, there are cases of people that have come from my background that have reacted an eye for an eye. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think might have happened is I left my body when I got that shock. It's life drained out of me. And I think that the shock was so much to take that my soul, I think, went back to my maker. And because this is very difficult to take for a parent, and I think I went into the loving arms of my maker. And maybe I came back with that vision, and that was my response. So it's a tough question.
It sure is. But let me ask you a question about why you wanted to contact the grandfather, the guardian of the boy who had killed your son. What did you want from him?
Well, after I had gotten over the shock, and 9 months after I lost my son, I'd spent a lot of time alone thinking about how and why I want to continue the rest of my life. And I had learned a lot about the vagaries and the challenge of youth violence in our country. I'd learned that we lose a child to a gun every hour and a half. And we lose one because of a loss of life, and we lose the other one to the incarceration system. And this children is too expensive. And I'm a naturalized citizen. I'm a proud citizen. And I felt that I had to do something about this problem now that I knew as much as I did. And I had also lost, quality in my life. And for life is to have a quality, you must have a sense of purpose. So I had an inspiration in the mountains to start a foundation that would fight this problem of youth violence, fight the forces that took my son's life, which would give me more meaning and would also help my country. So 9 months after I lost my son, I founded the Tariq Khamisa Foundation. And I talked to the district attorney who was at my house at the launch, and I told him that I'd like to meet Ples Felix. Hmm. And then he set up the appointment, and we met at the public defender's office, Henry Coker.
Let me turn to you, Ples Felix, and ask you what it was like to meet Azim Khamisa for the first time. Did you come to that meeting with a lot of trepidation?
Of course, I had a great deal of trepidation. I had high levels of concern because at the outset of my discovery that my 14-year-old grandson was responsible for the death of Tariq Khamisa, my prayer process began asking my Creator to create an opportunity for me to meet and spend time with, shake the hand of, and express my sympathies and condolences to Azim Khamisa and his family, and to commit to them my willingness and availability to do anything I can to help them with their loss.
My guests are Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix. Kamisa's son Tariq was murdered by Felix's grandson, Tony Hicks, who is now in prison. These two men now work together to try to prevent youth violence. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix. Kamisa started an organization named after his murdered son, the Tariq Kamisa Foundation. Felix serves on the advisory board. How did you become the guardian of your grandson, Tony Hicks?
It was a point of agreement between my daughter, Tony, and I that at the age of 9 years old, Tony would come and live with me here in San Diego and not be in South Central Los Angeles where he would be attracted to gangs.
Was he a kid in trouble, a kid that had potential for trouble living in South Central L.A.?
Tony, in every regard, fit the profile of a young kid who was born to a teenage girl whose raising may have been somewhat haphazard and certainly filled with inconsistencies. And it had always been my motivation to do what I could to assist my daughter in raising Tony. And at that point of 9 years old, we all determined that it was time for him to come and live with me in San Diego.
What could you do for Tony? What did you want to do for Tony?
Well, Tony, for me, is as close to a son as I'm ever going to get to in this life. Tony's mom is my only daughter, my only child. And I knew that Tony did not have a relationship with his natural father, which he wanted. It was necessary for Tony to have access to and day-to-day contact with an adult male figure who loved him, cared for him, and was willing and prepared to assist him in confronting and addressing all the basic requirements of growing up. I mean, from tying your shoes to brushing your teeth to making up your bed and doing your homework, all the necessary things to help him develop the values that would help him be a healthy, upright, and contributive member of our society.
Did you know he was in a gang?
No, I had no idea that Tony was in what we learned to be the black mob. I knew that he associated with two 14-year-olds on a regular basis, but beyond that, I had no clue.
How did he keep that hidden from you? And I think teenagers are very good at having secret private lives from their parents.
Well, Tony, unlike a lot of kids at 14 years old, was still very much in a strict regimen with respect to the requirements of him by me. Tony was required to be in the house before the sun sets. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, he was not available to go to these meetings they would have after 8 o'clock in the evening. And he never brought in any of the paraphernalia or any of the indicators, clothing, belts, no graffiti on his schoolwork and school books, none of the telltale signs, no rags hanging from his pocket, none of the language, none of the colloquialism use of gang language, no sign was ever brought into the house. As far as I was concerned, Tony always showed me the mannerable, well-treated, courteous young kid that he was.
So when you heard that he was in a gang was responsible for the murder of another person, what were your thoughts?
Well, I experienced a great deal of disappointment, anger, shock, betrayal, and downright loathsome heart sympathy for the family of Tariq Kamisa at my finding out that Tony was responsible for his death. Then after finding out subsequently to that Tony was a member of what was called the Black Mob, I literally had a great deal of surprise. And again, doing a lot of retrospection about how come I didn't know this? How come I didn't see the signs and signals? I went back to look for things and they weren't there. So a lot of surprise, a lot of disappointment, and a lot of hurt.
What was the attraction of the gang to Tony? What did it give him, you think, that he was looking for?
Well, based on conversations that I've had with him, it all began by his feeling comfortable in the association of his two 14-year-old friends that he had known since elementary school, and they had gone through junior high school together. These were his friends and supposedly people who looked out for him, looked out for his best interest. And then, of course, subsequent to this whole tragedy, I found out that Tony's real attraction to these kids and this one particular 18-year-old was that they allowed him to watch while they committed crimes. Mm. They didn't require him to be directly involved. They also allowed him to drink alcohol and smoke marijuana, which were things, of course, that would not be considered pardonable or even endorsable in my household. So he was allowed to do things with them that he certainly was not allowed to do in my household.
What kind of a student was he? And I imagine a kid with a real double life, that oftentimes academics suffer under these conditions.
Tony came to me when he came to me at 9 years old. He was a can't do kid. Daddy, I can't do this, I can't do that. So we had to really start from scratch with respect to basics like mathematics and reading and writing and computing. And in school, I reinforced with his teachers and his tutors and principals the need to keep me informed on a daily basis about his academic process. And Tony suffered some setbacks, but he was successful at the end of his elementary school career and rode that crest of success into junior high school through seventh grade. Eighth grade, things changed. He began to hang out with people, smoke marijuana. He didn't study. We had a great deal of back and forth about that. And I just began to see that the older he got, the more attracted he was to hanging out with people who were not interested in school.
Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix worked together to prevent youth violence after Felix's grandson killed Kamisa's son. They'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation with Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix. They were brought together by tragic circumstances. In 1995, Kamisa's son Tariq was murdered by Felix's grandson, 14-year-old Tony Hicks. Hicks was charged as an adult, pled guilty, and is serving a 25-year-to-life sentence in a California prison. Azim Kamisa started a violence prevention program, the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, and asked Ples Felix to serve on the advisory board. They visit schools together to talk to students about the devastating impact of violence on them and their families. Azim Kamisa, I assume you have talked to Tony Hicks to find out what happened that night.
No, I have not.
You haven't? On purpose?
Yes, in a way. I didn't have the emotional strength to face Tony till about this year. I have, although shared with Ples this year, that I would like to meet him. I think I needed the time to heal from this tragedy before I sat down with Tony.
It was too painful.
But one of the, it's excruciating in terms of pain, but I think it's beyond pain. It's an emptiness that, you know, will never, ever be filled. He was my only son, and tragedies like these hurt way down, way deep down. They scar the soul, and they scar the soul forever. It's a very difficult thing to withstand. It takes a lot of strength, you know, doing what we're doing, and but one of the close members of the foundation, Mike Reynolds, spent a lot of time with Tony. I think he interviewed Tony 20, 21 times. Mike and Ples have both shared with me. Tony is very remorseful, and he gave a very remorseful speech at his sentencing, in which he begs for my forgiveness and God's forgiveness. And this speech, and he took responsibility. There was never a trial. And he took a very long sentence. He accepted the first degree murder as an adult, which the sentence for that is 25 years to life. And his speech at sentencing has become a centerpiece of our programs in schools now. show this to the kids, and they're absolutely riveted by his words.
You mentioned the word forgiveness, Azim Kamisa. Do you forgive Tony Hicks for what he did? Are you
yes,
ready?
Yes, I have.
You have?
I have, and I do it every day. Forgiveness is not what I'm learning, an event. Forgiveness is a process. It is something you have to do on a daily basis.
Plus, Felix, in talking to your grandson, Tony, and as he talks about what happened, and he expresses the kind of remorse that he did at his trial, how does he speak those words? How does he express what he's sorry for?
Tony, being a teenager at this point and grappling with the whirlwind of his decision that resulted in the death of Tariq Kamisa, has expressed at key and critical times his sorrow, his remorsefulness in a variety of ways. Certainly the first time he really did that was the night before his sentencing, in which, for the first time, in an isolation cell in juvenile hall, he broke down and cried like a baby. And I hugged him and tried to console him, and he screamed over and over and over again, "Daddy, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm just so sorry. Please understand that I'm sorry and accept my forgiveness. Please tell Mr. Kamisa and his family that I'm so sorry." All I could do was to reinforce with him that he was doing the right thing with respect to taking the proper steps and taking responsibility, showing his forgiveness. And then he has expressed since then in his current incarceration that it's his life goal to strive to be an excellent person, to pursue his education, and to come out of the prison system willing, capable, and able to assist in the work that the foundation is doing.
He was tried as an adult. Does he belong in prison, Plus Felix?
According to the state of California law that's on the book right now, Tony belongs in prison for the nature of his crime. I personally do not feel that putting 14-year-olds and teenagers in adult prisons is an answer to the problem that our society faces. That's just my opinion. So the law of the land is such, until we change it, we do as much as we can, my family and I, to support Tony in his arduous task of making the adjustment as a teenager, 17-year-old, and being in one of California state prisons with adults where people do not love or care for him, and that he has to assure on his own device every day that he's secure and safe and is able to pursue self-study towards his GED completion.
As a parent outside of prison, do you feel some degree of helplessness to protect him inside of prison?
He's in the prison system. He is an inmate and a ward of the state of California. And to the extent that my daughter and I and other family members can support him while he's inside, we do that with visits on a periodic basis. We communicate with him through letters, encouraging him to pursue his education. But the state of California is now his primary parent and source of care, and all we can do is serve as a secondary source of support and encouragement to him from outside the prison system.
By being angry at society and, in a sense, holding society responsible for what happened to your son, does that get Tony off the hook? Does it then absolve him of some responsibility for his own actions?
No, I don't think that is the message I'm trying to impart. Tony is definitely a victim of society. My son was a victim of his assailant, and Tony was his assailant. And what he did is he took responsibility that he did it, and he took a very long sentence for 25 years to life. And I've gone on record saying that if Tony comes out and is rehabilitated and he does pursue in jail a course where he educates himself, that yes, there is a job waiting for him at the foundation, because he can help several other children not fall in the same trap he did. it's a restorative way in terms of dealing with this tragedy.
My guests are Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix. Kamisa's son Tariq was murdered by Felix's grandson, Tony Hicks. These two men now work together to prevent youth violence. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix. Let me turn back to you, Azim Kamisa, and have you describe for us what you hope your foundation does.
Well, we have a very personal story where we can put a face onto violence. And the strength of our particular program, which is called the Violence Impact Forum, we go into schools and we talk to 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders, 8 to about 14 years of age. And they hear how this tragedy devastated me and my family. And they also see what happened to Tony and how remorseful he is. And then they also hear from Ples and see how this tragedy has impacted Ples and his family. And we have a very high impact program. We do an extensive Q&A. Violence is very much on the minds of these kids. And during our forums, there's at least, and we speak to about 200 kids at any given time, and there's at least 25 to 30 hands in the air, and they want to talk about the violence.
And do you find that for many kids, this is to you, Ples Felix, that for many kids, they have a very direct connection to violence that is very present in their lives?
Absolutely. I don't think that we've been to one school as yet where the majority of the children have not expressed that either they have been directly impacted by violence or they've been indirectly impacted by it, by the loss of a friend or someone that they know, as well as a family member.
You said something earlier, Ples Felix, about children needing responsible adults in their life. In part, that's why you took over the guardianship of your grandson. How many kids that you deal with in these schools really don't have that kind of adult person in their life who can help them make important decisions?
While we've done no scientific polls, we do understand that the schools that we're focused in are schools that are deemed in areas of high risk with high unemployment, high crime, and the like. And these communities, of course, experience a great deal of single parent households, mostly female heads of households raising children, sons and daughters. And we know that when we go into these schools and we talk to these children, after the presentations, these children come to us and they want to share hugs and their condolences, as well as share with us other things. And in these hugs, in these embraces, you can tell that a young male child in the fourth or fifth grade is at such a level of tenseness and discomfort that at the point of contact, there is this tension. But after a while, the kid relaxes and just gets into the hug. But you know, this is not something that's common. It's something probably that's very extraordinary. And it takes a little while getting used to. So we know that many kids, male and female, don't have the kind of role models that they need and certainly don't get the consistent support they need. Their parents are busy working, trying to support them, and maybe things like little talks and little hugs are lower on the priority list.
Azim Kamisa, and I would imagine as you talk about your son's murder and do this over and over again, then on the one hand, it reconnects you with that tragic event, but at the same time, I'm curious whether over time, as you tell the story over and over again, whether that makes it any easier, whether it makes it any less painful.
It's you have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll have to deal with the loss of my son for the rest of my life. There's no way around it. There's a positive way of dealing with it, and there's a negative way of dealing with it. This work puts meaning in my life. It puts meaning in my son's life, that he did not die in vain. Sure enough, every time I speak about it, and as I'm doing right now, you know, you're opening up that wound.
Sure.
And I speak nationally, and there are days when I'm not able to speak, and I need some time, and I do a lot of crying after I do one of these sessions. It's getting easier. It used to be I was a basket case a week before and a basket case a week after. Now, and I'm okay up to the moment, but there is still, I still have to deal with it after one of these sessions. It's something that takes strength and something that I have to address. I hope that in time people tell me that it does get easier. It's been 3 years and 8 months. But you know, you think of him, I think of him every day. I mean, sure. I really do miss my son.
This is sort of an awkward question, but to you plus Felix, is your grandson a bad person?
No, my grandson is a loving, sensitive person who happened to allow anger, resentment, and a host of other kinds of things get him caught up in a whirlwind where his decision-making capacity got more and more distorted up to the point of pulling the trigger, and then he committed the worst act that he could have ever committed as a tragic mistake. But he is not a bad person. Tony murdered, but he is not a murderer. Does not go out seeking to continue that behavior, and certainly is very remorseful and sorry for it. And he's a loving person looking to be better and overcome the tragedy that this poor decision-making created for him.
Plus, Felix, I wonder what your life is like now or how different you are having worked with Azim Kamisa in the last couple of years. Are you a very different person?
I'm very different. I have a great deal of activities that are directed around volunteer efforts to support children in positive ways. Prior to this incident, I worked and I went home and I raised my grandson. I was very low profile, very private, and in many ways disconnected from a larger body of the San Diego community. Now, of course, since this tragedy, I am out and about, very visible. People know me when they see me. I have a lot of interaction with children in churches and clubs, in juvenile hall, in our county honor camps and other places where kids are incarcerated for relatively minor offenses. So my life has changed considerably.
And Azim, how are you changed by this tragedy?
It's a life-changing event. And, you know, there are many gifts that my son left me. One of the things he did is he connected me back with my heart. I used to live in my head a lot, as a lot of us do. And now I don't. I live more in my heart. You know, we come on earth to learn, to teach, but most of all to serve. I was always very active in philanthropy. Of course, now I spend I spend about 80% of my time in 96, and currently I spend half of my time because the other half of my time I try and make my living. And it's become, as I said, a ministry. Ples and I both speak a lot. I speak more nationally. Ples speaks more regionally. And we both work with children in this program. And And in a way, I feel that both of us are very privileged. How many of us have an opportunity to make a difference in our life, as Pleasant and I have been given the opportunity. Although it came from a very, very tragic incident, there is a satisfaction that we are making a difference and that we have an opportunity to better the outcomes for our children. It's really a very worthy cause.
Ples Felix and Azim Kamisa work together to prevent youth violence. Their organization, the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, is based in San Diego. Azim Kamisa has just written a book, Azim's Bardo, A Father's Journey from Murder to Forgiveness.